You have just heard a talk by Barbara Olshansky and David Lindoff, co-authors of the book The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. This program was recorded at a public forum sponsored by Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and Squeaky Wheel Productions and held at the United Church on the Green in New Haven, Connecticut, June 24, 2006. To order an audio CD or DVD video copy of this program, call area code 203-268-8446 or visit our website at www.squeakywheel.net and specify that you're ordering the impeachment talk. Again, for information on how to order this program in audio CD or DVD format, call area code 203-268-8446 or visit our website at www.squeakywheel.net. You can also mail your order to Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. This program was produced by Scott Harris in association with Squeaky Wheel Productions, distributors of the nationally syndicated Between the Lines weekly radio news magazine. Download or podcast new and archived Between the Lines programs on the web at www.btlonline.org. For Squeaky Wheel Productions, I'm Prue Cullen.
On December 10th, people are organizing for a Human Rights and Impeachment Day. To find out how to get involved in the organized impeachment movement, visit www.afterdowningstreet.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Jennifer Harbury is a human rights attorney and directs the Stop Torture Permanently campaign. Her latest book, Truth, Torture, and the American Way, reveals the long history of torture by the American state. Thanks to Andy in Rochester Indy Media, we bring you her presentation, as well as that of Ezat Moselanajad, a torture survivor who now helps other survivors cope. They both spoke at a forum on torture held at SUNY Buffalo, November 15th. Last week on the program, we aired a talk by Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst. I air material by Ray because he is one of the few from inside who's speaking out publicly as part of the peace movement. He has information on an inside track that few others have and is willing to put it to good purpose. I believe he is sincere, a decent person, but I am consistently disturbed by his perception that the CIA was a wonderful place, only recently perverted. But the situation, the observable situation, is that CIA operatives have been overthrowing governments, suppressing popular movements, and supervising and facilitating torture since they were founded after World War II. It has not changed, no matter who's in the White House or who's in Congress. CIA torturers were busy, even under the regime of the so-called great humanitarian Jimmy Carter. People have referred to this as the secret government, something that goes on generation after generation, seemingly untouched and untouchable by the electoral process, funded by black budgets and hidden behind classification. I don't know how it is to happen, but we can't become a decent nation until this is broken open and swept away. If you're doing something that's bad enough to have to keep secret, don't do it. Here's Jennifer Harbury.
Well, I'm very glad to be here tonight and certainly want to thank Professor Coble for setting up an amazing series on what I think is one of the most important issues that's facing all of us today. I'd like to just start by asking, how many of you here in the audience have either a friend or a relative of a friend who are in the military right now? That's what I figured. That's, I think, especially for this generation, all of you students, this is going to be the question of U.S.-sponsored torture, U.S. torture practices is going to be the issue that is really going to follow you for the rest of your lives. So what I'd like to do today is just present a lot of information, present the questions, present some of the data that goes with that, and then have a dialogue with you. I'd like to hear what you think and where you come to and together talk about what it is that you think we should do right now about this issue. When we first saw those photographs of Abu Ghraib flashing across our television screens, I was really pretty relieved to hear the pretty unanimous expression of outrage all across the United States. I was at that point doing public speaking everywhere, literally from New York City to Kansas to South Texas to California to Oregon, and I was really very, very relieved by the reaction. People were furious, and that's as it should be because torture has been banned in this country since the days of the Founding Fathers. It happens, but it has always been illegal. In the words of Patrick Henry, all of the colonists came to this country literally running away from torture, the rack, the screw, the star chamber back there in the old world. They came here to get away from that. And as he said, if we let those, quote, barbaric practices come here, we are lost and undone, unquote. That's really been with us since the Constitution was written throughout all of the rulings of the Supreme Court ever since until now. So what happened? How could it be that that all of these things were suddenly happening in Iraq? How did that happen? We heard three things from our administration, three questions, and these are the questions that I want to talk to you all tonight about. The first one was, actually, those were just a few bad apples. It was just a few badly trained young military people that got out of control. It was like Animal House. They got crazy. Don't worry, the American system has worked. We put them on trial. They've been court-martialed, and they're in jail. Justice is done. We're fine. America does not torture. Well, that's the first thing we heard, is it was a few bad apples. Why do they keep insisting that it was just a few bad apples? Why is that so important to them? Well, because if it's ordered from upstairs by higher-level officials like Mr. Rumsfeld, for example, or Mr. Bush, then those people, under the doctrine of command responsibility, they stand trial, Nuremberg style, not just the young soldiers that did it. That's why we keep hearing again and again, it was just them, just a few isolated instances like any army could have, and they're in jail. I'll get back to that question in a minute. Why are the MPs in jail and not the people that ordered those practices? Second, we keep hearing, well, but they're enemy combatants, so they're not covered by the Geneva Conventions. We'll get back to that in a minute. In fact, it's a felony under U.S. law. Anyone that carries out torture abroad goes to jail for 20 years. That's been in since 1996, in fact, for example. And the Geneva Conventions do cover these people, but we'll get back to that. The third thing, and maybe the most important question for all of us since September 11th, the administration keeps telling us, even if it did come from upstairs, we're not saying it did, but if it did, even if it's illegal, you have to let us do it because it's necessary to keep our country secure so that this never happens again. What if there was a ticking bomb? We need torture to keep Americans safe from another attack. True or false? Let's look at that. Let's look at all of this stuff with open eyes because the consequences are going to come to us later, better or worse. All right, first question. We saw the young MPs in those photographs clearly. They did what they did. They have been court-martialed. Well, they did what they did. They should have known better. They've gone to jail. But the bigger question was it really just a few MPs that were badly supervised or badly trained, or is this a policy? Are these torture practices really long-standing standard operating procedures that were ordered from upstairs, maybe just recently, maybe for 20 years? Who knows? Are these practices that everybody knows about, or these routines, or was this just a couple of crazy kids? Well, first, of course, we heard that it was just those kids, but then we started hearing that dogs, in fact, were routinely used all over Iraq, all over Afghanistan, and that was developed in Guantanamo and brought over there. So obviously, they didn't just dream it up. The same thing with certain kinds of stress and duress positions, waterboarding, which I'll get back to, holding people in positions of sexual humiliation, holding them under the stress and duress positions that become very painful. It turned out that that's being routinely practiced all over American bases everywhere, in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Guantanamo, and even where the CIA is bringing prisoners to be tortured somewhere else, like Egypt, the extraordinary renditions. We pick up the prisoner. We fly them in a special CIA plane. We deliver the prisoner with a list of questions to countries where we know they will be tortured, absolutely. And sometimes the CIA specialist even stands by to assist or supervise or give advice, aiding and abetting, in other words. At any rate, all of these torture techniques have been very routine for a long time. But what I'd like to talk about just a little bit tonight is that they didn't happen just after September 11th. These go way back. And that's what makes it so crucial for all of us to know how far back they go and also how painful are they. Because under the Convention Against Torture, to which the U.S. is a signatory, it's an illegal act of torture if you do anything that inflicts severe pain. What I heard at the UN twice this spring from different U.S. officials is we're not really torturing people. The techniques we use aren't quite torture. Also, it's not our policy. It was just a few kids that got out of line. Those are kind of contradictory, but those were the two things we heard. All right, let's take a step back to Latin America and Vietnam. Some of you may know my husband was tortured to death in Guatemala in the 1990s. Guatemala is very much like the old South Africa. It's 80% indigenous, the Mayans. They have basically no political representation, no land. They're starving to death. They have no unions. They're shot if they try to form unions. The malnutrition level is so huge that me, at the height of 5'3", I'm bigger than the average man in rural Guatemala. And the infant mortality rate is second only to Haiti in the Western Hemisphere. Most people are illiterate because no one's bothered to teach in their own languages, in the Mayan languages in the countryside, and the people still speak 23 Mayan dialects. They chose not to assimilate. They didn't like the conquistadors. There's been a Mayan uprising every single generation for 500 years. They rise up with machetes, stones, anything they can get their hands on because they don't want to see their kids starve to death. And every generation, they're crushed. That's what happened this last generation. There was a 35-year civil war during which 200,000 people, almost all of them Mayan, were taken away by the death squads, brutally tortured, and tossed into unmarked graves. There were 660 villages that were wiped off the map, with 300 people in an afternoon being killed. And the UN did fight genocide when that war ended on the part of the military. They found 97% of the war crimes that occurred were the military, and they severely chastised the CIA for having backed that military from day one. That army was put into power in 1954 through a violent coup, which was organized, in fact, and paid for by the CIA, very much like the coup we did in Chile. 200,000 death squad victims is more people than the death squad total in Chile, Argentina, Honduras, and El Salvador combined. My husband was an indigenous leader. He was in combat for 17 years. He was captured on March the 12th, 1992, and we were told he'd been killed in combat. Or to be more precise, we were told he'd turned his rifle around and shot himself through the mouth to avoid being captured alive. In 35 years of war, not one prisoner of war was ever returned alive. Zero. That's how many political prisoners were presented alive to the courts. Zero. No one wanted to be tortured to death by that particular military. 6 months later, we found out from an escaped prisoner that, in fact, he'd been captured alive and that an 18-year-old soldier had been hauled out to the combat site and battered to death until he was unrecognizable and buried in the grave, and I was sent my husband's description instead of the kid. Why was that? Because they wanted to be able to torture my husband long-term. His name was Everardo, by the way. They wanted to torture him long-term with a doctor present until he broke psychologically and gave all of his information away. They didn't want to kill him. They wanted to torture him, if need be, for several years. The witness that was able to escape said that the last time he saw him, he was strapped down to a metal bed and had been injected with a toxic gas that caused his body to swell so badly that one arm and leg hemorrhaged, and they were tightly bound up. I later learned that they also tortured him until he agreed to lead them to a radio station, a clandestine radio station that they wanted information about, except he tricked them and led them into an ambush, at which point they decided he was about to escape, and they placed him in a full body cast, cement from ankles to a neck so that he could not escape, and then either threw him out of a helicopter or dismembered him and scattered him across a sugarcane field after 2 years of torture. During that time period, I had been quite active. I had done a number of hunger strikes, one for 32 days in front of the National Palace, asking for him to be released to the courts of law. I'd gone to the State Department every week for years. I'd gone to everyone on Capitol Hill, and Congress had repeatedly asked the State Department for information, and they got the same answer I did. There's no information at all about him. We're trying to find out. We don't know anything. After my third hunger strike in 1995, a congressman came out with very startling news. He'd been lied to for several years himself, even though he was on the Intelligence Committee. He said, the State Department and the CIA have known from the first week where your husband was. Let him be tortured for 2 years because they were, in fact, paying the torturers to get the information. They knew exactly where he was, and the torturing team of intelligence officials was on CIA payroll. So they just let him die and let me stay out there on those hunger strikes for no reason at all. They knew where he was according to the CIA's own files from the week he was picked up. There's a bulletin that went over to the State Department that same week, 6 days after his capture. 2 months later, when I was banging on their door, there's another bulletin that says, oh, yes, he's still alive. So are 350 other prisoners who are about to be killed. They're in the torture cells right now. All of those people are dead. We might have been able to save many of them. In his files, there's also a very interesting bulletin that says the prisoners at a certain military base are being held in pits of water so deep that they have to hang on to overhead bars to keep from drowning. It's called the water pit. We're using it right now in Afghanistan. It's a standard technique that we've been involved with for a very long time. We kept hearing about the dogs being some crazy stunt those particular dog trainers just thought up. But my friend, Sister Diana Ortiz, who was an American citizen nun, was hideously tortured in Guatemala also, and dogs were used on her. What's extraordinary about her case? After she'd been gang-raped, left with 112 cigarettes on her back alone, attacked by dogs and left in a pit full of dead bodies and rats, an obvious North American came in with a heavy American accent speaking bad Spanish and said, are you crazy? She's a U.S. citizen. It's all over the radio. You have to give her back to me. He knew who she was, where to find her, and he had authority over the torturers. He could just walk into this secret place. And his torturers answered, okay, boss, and they handed her over. He drove her out of there and said, I'm taking you to my buddies over at the embassy. You have to forgive the torturers. They're trying to fight communism. She dumped out of the Jeep. The next day went back to the embassy after she'd contacted her nuns and gotten to a safe place and begged them to go find this guy and send him back to save all the Guatemalans who are dying in that torture cell. And for 10 years, I heard the State Department say, well, Sister Diana, she doesn't really know what happened to her. She's mentally unstable. You really can't believe anything she says. Years later, she had drawn with a police artist a sketch of this man, this obvious American. And years later, we came across a photograph of the local CIA guy that was released by someone who had worked for the government also. Striking resemblance. Not only that, that's dogs, that's water pit. Two of my friends from Guatemala, one from El Salvador, had been subjected to what they call waterboarding nowadays. That happened to them down there. They both had North Americans in their cell giving advice and supervising. What is waterboarding? I'm going to use this as an example because I want you to beware of sanitized language from our government officials. People make things sound not so bad so that you won't get up and fight about it. What did they say nowadays that waterboarding is? The CIA uses it in Iraq, in Afghanistan, everywhere they go. They say, we hold the prisoner's head underwater until he thinks he is going to drown. Quote unquote, kind of like a pool dunking, right? Nothing to get upset about. What does my friend Antoniel say it was like? They held my head under water until I started choking, and all of the water went into my head, and it burned like crazy, and I thought my eardrums were going to rupture. They kept holding me down, and I was gagging and vomiting into the water. Then I went into convulsions. The next thing I knew, they were giving me CPR on the floor. Then they drowned me again. Torture? Or pool dunking, which one? Severe pain, mock execution, that's torture, that's illegal, that's a felony, and it's a violation of international law. Be very careful of the sanitized language that we keep being given. We did it, we're doing it in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo, we did it all over Latin America. It was very, very common, it was a standard technique. We hear about the stress and duress positions where you hold somebody in an uncomfortable position. We saw those in the photographs, right, where someone's bent backwards at a strange angle or they're hanging from bars. And Rumsfeld, in fact, has his signature at the bottom of a list of some of those, saying it's okay to use those. And at the bottom he wrote, I stand 8 hours a day. Why shouldn't the prisoners stand for 4 hours? Well, the problem is when we stand around all day working and stuff, we're constantly moving in small ways so that the lymph doesn't build up in our arms and legs, right? If you have to stand stock still, or if you're hung in one of those quote-unquote stressful positions for a long period of time, it becomes agonizing because you're standing so still. My friend Herbert Anaya in El Salvador was forced to stand all night for several nights. And when his wife finally was able to send a lawyer over to the police station where he was being secretly detained with American military advisors there who gave permission for the lawyer to get in, they had a blanket over Herbert Anaya's lap. He was released since they'd found out where he was. They couldn't exactly detain him any longer. And when he got out, he said, yeah, they came down and got me, but they couldn't get the shoes back on my feet, so they finally had to just cover me up with a blanket. They didn't want anyone to see. He was shot to death on his front lawn not long later in front of his kids as he tried to put them into the car to take them to daycare. Inez Murillo in Honduras, who has always said there was an American named Mr. Mike that came to see us all the time. He was constantly coming in and chatting with the torturers and giving advice and asking questions. And the CIA later admitted, well, yeah, he was. And that was one of our guys, in fact. She was a prisoner of Battalion 316. She was also attacked by the crazy dogs, which she is still remembers with absolute terror. But she was also held in those stress positions where they would tie the hands and feet behind her back and hang her from the ceiling and leave her there. I said, how stressful was that? She said, it dislocated my shoulders. She said the worst, though, was the constant threats that they were going to go pick up her family and throwing ice water in her face every 15 minutes all night long for days on end. She said the sleep deprivation becomes excruciating. It's much worse than the actual physical beating that she was taking. Electrical shocks we're still using. Dan Mitrione, U.S. special operations person, taught that in Brazil and Uruguay. And our friends had that happen to them in the presence of North Americans in Guatemala and El Salvador. Mario, my friend from Guatemala, who was tortured twice in Guatemala, remembers especially having a North American come in and saying, no, no, put the wires over there under his teeth there. That's where the nerve ending is. It'll hurt more. My friend, a doctor from El Salvador, who recently was victorious in that case against the Salvadoran generals, remembers psychological pressures, like lying in a coffin while they dug the maggots out of a festering bullet wound they hadn't treated, placing the bullets on his chest and kicking him in the back of the head, saying, eat the maggots, and of course he couldn't reach. But what he remembers is the American standing there laughing, saying, do it again, that was funny. We've been doing this for a very long time. The CIA specifically has been doing this for a very long time, and those poor MPs, and I say poor, yes, they should have known better, but they were very young, poorly trained, and they were following orders, and they've said at all of their trials, all of their court martials, that's what those CIA guys told us to do. When their lawyers went back and tried to see who the CIA people were on duty that night, they found Special Agent James Bond, Special Agent John Doe, and the CIA would not give the military lawyers the information about who they were. When that whole huge military investigation was going on, the CIA never contributed one sheet of paper. They just answered and said, we'll do our own investigation and we'll let you know. Not one sheet of paper. All right, it's been going on a long time. Those techniques weren't invented recently. In fact, that picture of the guy in the hood on the box with his hands outstretched. In military intelligence circles, that's known as the Vietnam position because that's where it was developed. Nothing new. The rising and falling temperatures, Vietnam. It goes all the way back. Is it legal? We were told, you know, it's just a few bad apples, but anyway, it's perfectly legal because they're enemy combatants. What do the Geneva Conventions say? Geneva Conventions for prisoners of war, they cannot be tortured, but you're only a prisoner of war if you're in uniform and part of a formal army. So a street insurgent might not be a prisoner of war. All right. That's true. He might not get prisoner of war protections. Can he be tortured? No, because the other convention, the fourth convention, applies to all people who are not in uniform and part of a formal military. They're all civilians. And that particular convention covers even people who are insurgents, saboteurs, and people who even carry out acts of deadly force against an occupying power. Do they have to be left in the streets to attack us again? Well, of course not. You pick them up the same as we did in Waco, the same as we did in Oklahoma City. You pick them up, you bring them to trial, and you put them in prison. If we have the death penalty, so be it. You do that. But you don't just pick them up and torture them. They cannot be tortured. under any circumstances under the Geneva Convention. We're also signatories to the Convention Against Torture, which flatly prohibits it. Also the ICCPR, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And since 1996, not long after the scandal in Washington over my husband's murder, at which point the Senate Intelligence Committee held a hearing and said to me in front of several hundred people in the audience, "This is shocking. Americans can never do torture. It will never happen again. It was a few bad apples and we fired them, but it will never happen again," 1996. Shortly after that, they passed a statute that made it a felony to pay for torture, conspire to torture, or aid and abet torture in a foreign country. But we're doing it massively. Last month, for the first time in the history of this country, we legalized it. We legalized torture just before the elections. If a person is tortured and gives a confession, that can be used against him at trial. Unheard of. Why? Why can you never use a confession obtained through torture? Because a person will sign anything if you're torturing him. It has zero credibility. Of course, especially if your child's being hurt in front of you, you're going to sign. And by the way, the American forces are doing that. We are picking up people's children and their wives. And we're hurting them. There's the case of the Iraqi general that was finally broken when they brought his very fragile, asthmatic 17-year-old son in front of his two-way window, stripped him naked in the cold, and doused him with ice water until he started shivering and going into hypothermia. Now, how legal is that? We picked up the elementary school children of Khalid over in Pakistan and apparently threatened to shoot them in front of the father, who answered, "At least they'll go to a better place." How legal was that? At any rate, that statute went into effect in 1996. It's a felony to do what we have been doing. Since the Nuremberg trials, it's been something you go to prison for, especially the people at the top. Nuremberg was not about putting every single young German soldier into jail for what happened. It was about putting the architects into prison so that it doesn't happen again. All right, core question then. What this is really about, where the real debate is in this country, is do we have to have torture to stay safe? We all saw September 11th. No one wants to see that again, right? Not one of us ever wants to see a horror like that take place again. But does torture prevent that? I think all of us have seen the many, many documents that, in fact, the CIA and the White House and the Security Council and the FBI actually had before that attack, warning them about it, that they didn't use. Out of the Philippines, the report that Al-Qaeda's planning to fly airplanes into tall buildings in the United States. The memo that said Al-Qaeda determined to attack imminently in the United States a month before it happened. The FBI people like Colleen Rowley that were saying desperately, "There's this weird Al-Qaeda guy suspect here that wants to learn to fly a plane but not take off and land, just fly." And they couldn't get the messages connected. We do have an intelligence problem, but it's not that we aren't gathering data. It's that we're not using it correctly, and we're not interpreting it correctly. What happens if we torture people? Do we get good information? The answer any intelligence expert will tell you is no. You can torture the living daylights out of someone, and they'll tell you anything that they think you want them to hear. You'll get Niagara Falls back, but it won't be accurate. There's nothing to make the person say something that's actually true. You'll just get this barrage of information. My husband, in 2.5 years of torture, said nothing true. Not one thing. That's why he got killed in the end. He just wouldn't talk. Then there's someone like Sister Diana Ortiz, who after about 80 burns on her back, they held up a photo of someone who looked nothing like her and said, "Is that you?" And she said, "No." So they burned her. So she said, "Okay, yes." I mean, people will say anything under torture. You don't get good information. Mr. Aboud is a good example after Iraq. He was released with that first group after those photographs of Abu Ghraib aired across our television sets. And what did he say? "Well, first I was tortured under Saddam Hussein at Abu Ghraib. I got out. I was glad when the Americans got rid of Saddam Hussein. I thought I saw a bomb in the back of a car, and I wasn't real happy with the Americans by then because I thought they were making a lot of mistakes, but I reported it to the Iraqi police. They grabbed me by the arms and turned me over to the American soldiers, who put me back in Abu Ghraib and tortured me again, using all of those same techniques." After he was released, a Washington Post person asked him about his experience, and she said, "What did you say under torture?" He said, "I signed a confession saying I'm Osama bin Laden in disguise." You know, it's like whatever you want. He knew what he had to do. He said he was Saddam Hussein's driver. I mean, he just said everything in order for them to stop torturing him. In the end, the Washington Post person said, "Well, now what's going to happen? Are you going to go join the insurgents and throw bombs?" And he got really quiet, and he said, "What would you do if someone came to your country and tortured you and raped you and broke all of your laws? Would you resist?" How many people in this audience would resist if that happened here? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a common sense question, isn't it? A more serious case, Libby was a very important prisoner who was picked up early on in the whole war against terror, right after September 11th. And he was first handed over to the FBI, which was always the organization doing that kind of intelligence gathering. That's their job. And they said they were using the kinds of techniques they've always used, which do not include torture. They'd been using them for a very long time, and they'd really honed them down. They're not fast, but they've worked. What are some of those techniques? Well, good cop, bad cop, incentives and disincentives, but also very slowly building a rapport with the prisoner. That gets you good intelligence. Torture doesn't. They started getting some information from him, which has since panned out. At that point, the CIA got in a big turf battle with the FBI, and there was a huge fight. The CIA won and took him away, sexually humiliated him, strapped him down, took him to Egypt, where he was very badly tortured. What did he say? "There's weapons of mass destruction over there in Iraq. Go ahead." And so we did. I mean, you cannot act on information obtained through torture. Only a fool would act on information obtained through torture. Does rapport really work? Well, very slowly. I think the most interesting technique I've heard of so far came out of, I believe, someone in the Mossad, of all places, who said Americans should not even go into the interrogation rooms anymore after what's happened. You know, people are so angry now, you should just forget it. But what you should do is send in a religious leader, send in an imam to sit down and talk with a prisoner over a long period of time, the same way you would someone in a cult in this country, and talk about what the religion really means and let people just slowly come down and come around. You know, send in someone that they can relate to and talk to in the end. And that, to me, makes the most common sense of all. Let's talk for a minute about the ticking bomb thing that we keep hearing, because that is the justification. We've all seen it on that, you know, program 24 and stuff. That has always been the justification. One day there might be a nuclear bomb under Grand Central Station, and you have to let us use torture to make that not happen. If a CIA guy picks up a suspect, you have to allow torture. Well, to start with, if that ever really did happen and the nuclear bomb was found and turned off in time, you know, that person's not going to be prosecuted. I mean, that's what presidential pardons are for, right? Our legal system is already in place for an extraordinary situation like that. But let's go through the logic of this ticking bomb thing step by step. Does this really make any sense at all as a reason? I mean, certainly we don't want a weapon of mass destruction going off in New York City or anywhere else in the world. But supposing the CIA picked up a suspect under those conditions, and they were really pretty sure that person was part of the plot. Let's go through it step by step. Possibility number one, they pick up the wrong person. That happens. You know, someone that looks the same or has a similar name or used a false ID or who knows. They torture that person, and he'll say, "Right, it's over there under that room." You go running over there, it's not there, the bomb goes off. Because, of course, if you're torturing the person, he'll say something. Possibly, because the whole idea is that it has to be something that's going to go off imminently. There's no way to use other methods. It has to be a bomb that's going to go off within 3 or 4 hours. All right, supposing they pick up someone, and he, in fact, is part of the plot. Let's supposing that happens. You pick up that person and you torture him. Well, fine, but the CIA book on how to do covert ops with their security rules are the same basic rules that all underground operations groups in the world use. The first most fundamental rule is compartmentalization. You only know information if you need to know it, because you could get picked up and tortured. So even if it's your best friend, even if it's your partner and you work together on planning the whole thing to make that bomb go off, unless you place the bomb, you don't know where it is. So you torture the person who really was high up in the plot, but he really doesn't know where it is. He'll talk under torture, give you false information. You go over there and the bomb still goes off over here. Last possible scenario, you pick up the right person. He does know where it is. Well, if he's that high up, he's been extraordinarily trained and also very carefully selected. So that for the first 24 hours, again, this is the same rule book for security that the CIA uses. First 24 hours, he will say something false. He'll be tortured. He'll be talking, but it'll be false. People manage that. Everardo managed for 2 years, in fact. So again, you go down there where he tells you the bomb is over there, and it's going to go off over there. Last possibility, for some reason, the person is the right person and tells the truth. Well, it's been probably a couple hours since you picked him up. If he's that high up in a plot that's that sensitive, then he's been under watch by all of his colleagues every 10 minutes. They're going to know within 10 minutes if he's missing or been captured, and the bomb's been moved somewhere else already. You really can't win if it's just 3 hours away. I wish there was a magic way to make the person talk. It's not going to happen. The only thing we can do to properly protect ourselves is the next time a bulletin goes to the White House saying Al-Qaeda determined to attack in the United States now, come home from the ranch. We've got to get much better with our intelligence. Just myself, reading the bulletins about what Evarardo said to his torturers, and which was very much believed by the CIA, it's astounding to me. They didn't know the first thing about the realities on the ground in Guatemala. They didn't understand anything about the country they were responsible or assigned to. How can that be? I mean, he just made up ridiculous things and said those things under torture that would make everybody else laugh. The CIA believed them for a very long time. But we have to get much, much better on this. We can't let our political position skew our understanding of the information or intelligence we're getting. It can't allow us to trust intelligence assets that will tell us anything just because they want to get paid off. That month that Colonel Alpidez was seen bending over my husband's body with the toxic gas that made his body swell so badly, he got $44,000 from the CIA that month. That's like 10 years' worth of salary for most Guatemalans. I mean, of course, he'd torture him a whole bunch more. And if he didn't get good information, he'd make up some. I mean, whatever it takes to get the check, right? I mean, we have to change these techniques. They're foolish. Lastly, I'd like to talk just really briefly about what is the cost, what's the downside of torturing people? Because, you know, maybe it's true, like if you torture a young person in Iraq to find out the license plate of the car that was seen in the house down the street, maybe someone with no training who's terrified or wants to save their child, maybe they'll say something, but it's going to be low-level information. What's the downside? Let's look at history. If you sow the seeds of rage and hatred in a country you're trying to subdue with these hugely harsh, terrifying methods, knocking doors down, kidnapping children, torturing, raping, humiliating, do people lie down or do they fight harder? Well, Ireland isn't exactly quiet up in the north, is it? We didn't win the war in Vietnam. Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa. Let's look at the Middle East. I was very curious as to, you know, what had happened in Israel. Algeria, France is another example, but I wanted to look at the current situation with suicide bombers in Israel, Palestine, because we have all of the old profiles and they don't fit anymore. It's much broader, the kinds of people. Now it's women suicide bombers, for example. Many of them are very well educated. As we found out on September 11th, a lot of them can fly airplanes. So the stereotype we had of kind of religious fanatics who were poor and poorly educated and just frustrated, that's really a bunch of baloney. I mean, the whole thing about they're just jealous of us over here, it's like, I don't think so. What is the profile then? What are the common denominators? That was a really hard one for me because my father's family was in the Holocaust, but I went over to Israel to find out, because I couldn't get any information off the website or any other place about the current profile. I worked with B'Tselem and a bunch of Palestinian field organizers and field human rights workers, and we found out just by gathering basic data that the number of suicide bombers from the first intifada to the second, after all those harsh security measures were put in place, almost tripled. Where are they clustered? Gaza, Jenin, Ramallah area? Bethlehem, all of the places where the harshest measures are in place. So then the question was, is there trauma? Is that a common denominator? If we traumatize the living daylights out of a community, do they fight harder or do they suddenly sit down and stop fighting? Well, I don't think you'd be surprised. I couldn't get the person in Gaza, couldn't get out of his house because there was a lockdown. So he couldn't do the different interviews there. But we did 40 in the Ramallah and Jenin area. And out of those 40, 39 had extreme trauma. The young woman that got so much publicity when she carried out a suicide bombing. It was very interesting. She worked for the Red Crescent. So everyone was saying, a woman who worked for the Red Crescent, how could this be? Because she killed a number of people in that bombing. But when you read her history, she had spent several years carrying her dying friends to the ambulance, at one point carrying a very close childhood friend to an ambulance with his brains falling out in her hands. Some of the other people that we did interviews for, things like father and five brothers came home from an Israeli prison and were basically vegetables. They couldn't talk. They were completely unstable. You know, things. My mother was shot to death in front of the door coming home from the grocery store carrying the baby. I mean, things that no child would ever forget. Professor Pape, I believe, did a much more intensive study of suicide bombers around the world, and he found there is a common denominator, occupation and humiliation, i.e. trauma. So if we're in Iraq doing humiliation, trauma, and occupation, have we made ourselves more safe or much less safe? Well, they used to throw flowers to our troops. We're up to 50 bombs a day against our troops. So who's paying the price of throwing away the Geneva Conventions? Your friends and family. They're the ones getting shot at first. Next, after those people on the front lines getting killed or mutilated or whatever, it comes back here in the next attack. You know, what are we going to do about this? Also, do we want to be this way? Is this what we want our face to be? I was born just after World War II ended, and I was in Germany recently and compared notes with a lot of the German people my age. They grew up starving and in a near pariah status. They had done nothing. They weren't Nazis. They weren't born yet. But they paid for what their fathers did in that war. Just there was no place they could go in the world that people didn't look down on them and basically treat them with disgust. Is this what we want for our national face? Is it wise? Is it necessary? Is it legal? Is it humane? I think the answer is no on all fronts, but I want to hear more from all of you when we do the question and answer session. Thank you very much.
That was Jennifer Harbury, human rights lawyer, author of Truth, Torture, and the American Way, and director of the Stop Torture Permanently campaign. Next, Azat Mohsen-Elajad, a torture survivor who works with the Canadian Center of Victims of Torture.
Good evening. First of all, I apologize for my accent. There is a saying that an immigrant is a person who has lost everything except the accent. If you don't follow me, ask me the question. I'm very happy to be among a circle of wise people. At the same time, I'm scared because when you are in a circle of wise people, you can't speak nonsense. I work with the Canadian Center for Victims of Justice. I wear two hats. I work as a frontline worker helping survivors of war and torture on an ongoing basis for the last 15 years. I also work as a policy analyst and researcher at the center. And it's nice to have two hats, but it's upsetting that you have no hair at all. And I want to start with a joke. One day, a group of Georgians, because Stalin, as you know, is from Georgia, they paid a visit to Stalin, to the great Stalin. Then they were friends, old friends. They chatted about everything of shoes and chips, of cabbages and the kings, and why seawater is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings. All these things you have read in Alice in Wonderland. Then when they left, Stalin looked for his pipe. He loved his pipe so much. Then maybe somebody has taken my pipe. He called the head of intelligence, Bria. Okay, then some friends came to visit me, and somebody might have taken my pipe. Then make an investigation. It's not harmless. Let's see. A friendly investigation. And he said, okay, no problem. Next day, he called Bria. What happened to your investigation? And just laughingly, Bria said, five of them were killed under torture, and other five have confessed that this stealing pipe is a big part of a big global conspiracy against revolution. And Stalin said, I just found my pipe. Then the head of intelligence said, okay, those who have lost their lives, they are martyr for the revolution. And those who are in jail, if they behave nicely, we would just release them after some time. This is torture. What Jennifer told you, that torture doesn't bring any fruit. It is an insult to human dignity. And it destroys our aspiration to live in a planet with peace. Let me share with my experience with you. There are certain dates that you never forget. It was 25th of April 1973. I was working as a deputy general manager in the Ministry of Energy. Two men with plain clothes came and said, is that? I said, yes. They said, put your hands on the top of your head. I did that. They handcuffed me from the back in my own office, and they guided me in a car, blindfolded me. And then we reached a place. They pushed me, and using verbal abuses, inside a dungeon. They tied my hands and legs and started flagging on the sole of my feet. It is extremely difficult. With every blow, all your body pains, you shake. You are ready to do anything to stop, getting lashes. And they don't give you any information. They always insist, give information. And they always bluff you. Where are the guerrillas? Where are the weapons? So where did you hide guerrillas, etc., etc.? Nothing. Because I was a journalist. I was a human rights worker in Iran. So I was working for a society based on social justice and on pluralism. They connected me immediately with guerrillas. 4 years of jail. And let me tell you that. Just the first day was the worst, because up to 3 a.m. they tortured me, and they knew how to torture. And when I didn't feel pain because the skin was torn, they knew, and they immediately stopped torturing me. Then for 24 hours, I used to pass blood instead of urine. For 7 days, a soldier used to take me in his arm to the washroom. And for 50 days, I couldn't walk. And 4 years in jail. For what? For just writing? For just giving talk to people like yourself? And if you ask me what is the worst experience, I tell you, this is helplessness. When you are in jail, they can do whatever they like to do with you, and you have no power. You can't do anything. The only thing you can do is to resist. And how far you can resist? Because they just reduce you to your basic instinct of survival. And at that point, you are not yourself. You might say anything to them. Because the purpose of torture is to dehumanize a human being. To just kill your personality without killing you physically. And while torturing you, because I escaped Iran, then I devoted myself wholeheartedly to human rights, to refugee protection, to protection of survivors of torture. I taught political economy for some time in India, but I sat down with political economy. There are hundreds of people suffering. Then I became a frontline worker. You know what happens to you? The trauma of torture is totally different from other types of trauma. Because all of us go through trauma. Because after all, human being is a mortal being. You lose your parents, you lose your friends, especially at the old age, bereavements after bereavements. That is trauma. But torture is different. Because while torturing you, they try to convince you that you don't worth anything. You're a piece of filth. They degrade you all the time. And sometimes they use some techniques that you feel to die rather than to see that happens. For example, they force your friend, close friend, to torture you. And they torture your children or they torture your wife. I have a client who has become paranoid. And right now he is in hospital. Just before coming to you, yesterday I spent 2 hours after 5 o'clock to write a letter of support for him because he can't live in a small flat where he's surrounded with lots of drug addicts and government doesn't pay attention. I applied for housing for him. What happened to him? Why he is on and off in hospital? They tortured him in Iran. Then they called his mother. They started torturing his mother and asking him to confess. Mother told him, "Mom, don't tell them anything. Let them kill me." And they got angry and they murdered mother before the eyes of son. So he withstood torture, but after release, then gradually he became paranoid. I can't do anything for him except stabilizing his case. That is helplessness. And also, while torturing you, they play popular music. They play beautiful verses from the Holy Scripture. You know, every section of Holy Quran begins with this marvelous phrase. In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. When they torture you, they recite this verse from the Holy Scripture. And when they shoot people, they do the same thing again. God all merciful turns into God all revengeful at the hands of torturer. And this is torture. Sometimes they play sounds of animals, braying donkey or a barking dog. Then what happens to you when you go out? Everywhere you go, you hear verses from the scripture or sounds of animals or beautiful popular music. Life becomes hell to you. One day in Montreal, I was invited to a wedding. Then they started playing a music that they used to play during my torture. I collapsed. And nobody knew what was the reason. So you are traumatized for the rest of your lives. And I want to share another experience with you. I'm sorry. I wanted to speak with you about good things. I'm taking you deep inside the hell. And you go to the hell, to enter the hell, you need a strong will and great courage. Please be with me. Then, while torturing you, there are all the time they know what is your weak point. And they focus on that weak point. And they have their own psychologist. They invent torture. They torture me to death. I didn't tell them anything. And then the chief torturer told me, "Oh, you think that you can resist? I would invent a special torture for you. For the time being, I order somebody to come and push boiling water inside your rectum, and we would burn you. And then, in jail, so they torture people all the time. And from early morning to late evening, you always hear different types of screams. And through screams, we could identify what type of torture was going on. And one torture I want to share with you, and this is unfortunately going on today in many countries, and I have clients whom I have sent to our physicians, burning body. How did they do it in my time? They used to make you totally naked, tie your hands and legs in a naked bed. Under the bed, there was a flame. There was enough distance between your buttocks and the flame. They pushed your abdomen for 1 second, 2 seconds, so your buttock touched the flame. Believe me, I have not gone through torture, but I have heard screams coming out of this torture when two women were going through this type of torture. And also a young boy. So the young boy was 17. They just arrested him. I didn't know the rule of torturers. Poor, simple boy asked this guard, "What is the time, sir?" And torturer thought that he had a kind of appointment with a gorilla, and they needed urgent information to be abstracted from him, to be extracted from him. They burned him. Poor boy became lunatic.
I apologize for that abrupt ending. That is how it was given to me. The speaker was Ezat Mosalenajad with the Canadian Center of Victims of Torture, himself a torture survivor from Iran. A word on the CIA and Iran of special relevance given the government saber-rattling toward that country. The fact that Iran has a regime of religious fanatics hostile to the United States is the fault of the U.S. and the U.K. This was covered in a previous show some time ago, so you may not be aware of these facts. Iran was the victim of the first CIA-fomented coup. It happened in 1954. Iran, a constitutional monarchy, elected Mohammad Mossadegh prime minister. Mossadegh was determined to better the lot of the common people by using the money from Iran's oil. He nationalized the oil, which was being sucked out of there at bargain basement prices by British oil companies. They persuaded the Eisenhower administration that Mossadegh was a dangerous communist. CIA officer Kermit Roosevelt, nephew of Teddy, was dispatched with a bag of cash. He hired mobs to rampage through the capital, causing such chaos that the military was then called to depose Mossadegh. The Shah, the monarch, had fled the country when Mossadegh was elected. He was returned and kept in power for 25 years by the U.S. He employed a feared secret police force, the Savak, who were busy torturing anyone who disagreed with the Shah, including the speaker you just heard. This went on until the Iranian Revolution in 1979, 25 years of hell. The Iranians had not forgotten. Most Americans don't even know about it. I don't know how these people who've been tortured can forgive their torturers. You can download this and other shows from the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks for listening.